WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
John McPhee just won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for his book Annals of the Former World, which combines four previously published volumes about the geology of the United States. As William Howarth once put it, McPhee stretches the artistic dimension of reporting. Over the years, he's written about people, places, and phenomena that interest him. In addition to his work about the natural world, he's profiled tennis star Arthur Ashe, basketball player and senator Bill Bradley, curator Tom Hoving, and physicist Ted Taylor. His book Oranges told the botanical processing and marketing history of the ever-popular citrus fruit. McPhee lives in Princeton, where he grew up. Much of his work was first published in The New Yorker. I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book The Control of Nature, through reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides.
You're notoriously obsessive about your writing. Can you describe how you organize the notes that you've taken back with you from the place that you've been writing about?
Well, I copy them all first on a typewriter, it used to be, and now it's in a hard disk. And then when all the notes are assembled in this one document, I study that and look for a structure for the piece of writing that will rise out of those notes, rise organically out of the material that I have there, and not be imposed from the outside. I mean, a prefabricated structure is not what I would want to find, but an organization, a sequence for the material that I would be dealing with, and that makes sense and that yields the best result through juxtapositions of things and whatever can legitimately be done within the context of a factual piece of writing. And that excites me quite a bit, and it might last for several weeks with a long piece as I try to figure all this out and then arrange it so that when I begin a piece of writing, I always know where it's going to end and where it's going to go. The notable exception to this is that I haven't mentioned is that I always write a beginning, a lead, first, because that really primes the pump. If you have a successful lead and you know that it works and it makes sense in terms of the piece, that it doesn't promise too much, and that it arrests attention in a fair way, then I stop and go back and do all that organizing I'm talking about.
Can I read you the lead from the first essay in The Control of Nature?
Please.
And I'd like to know how you hit on this and knew that this would be the way to start. 300 miles up the Mississippi River from its mouth, many parishes above New Orleans and well north of Baton Rouge, a navigation lock in the Mississippi's right bank allows ships to drop out of the river. In evident defiance of nature, they descend as much as 33 feet, then go off to the west or south.
So why did I use that lead?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the ships are dropping out of the river and going off to the west or south. If that's happening, the river must want to go there too. So we have the very basic situation, but it's presented in terms of the ships and in a way that I hope will
exemplify.
Exemplify it and make somebody want to find out. Hey, why is this? Why would a big boat go out of the Mississippi River 300 miles from its mouth and go downhill on water? There's something odd about that. And of course, the something odd about that is what the whole piece is about. And I like to say that a lead ought to shine like a flashlight down into the whole piece, if possible.
Although you spend much of your life talking to people, for pieces that you'll be writing, you actually do very few interviews yourself. I mean, you allow yourself to be interviewed very seldom. And I was wondering why.
Well, I don't know. It's complicated. First of all, I'm always behind in my work. But for another thing, it's my work that I hope that will be known, not so much myself. I mean, I enjoy doing this once in a while, but I prefer just to publish the material and go home.
Mm-hmm. This explains too why there's
not a very good answer.
Well, this explains too why there's so few pictures of you.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think a writer should intrude between a piece of writing and a reader.
But you use the first person in your pieces.
Where I have to. If I have to. I mean, there are situations, if you're on a canoe trip with a group of people and you're one of the people, it would be ridiculous not to. And if there's other situations, I did a thing once about an experimental aircraft. It was called the Deltoid Pumpkin Seed. And it was 60,000 words long, and there was one place in this whole story where I needed to appear as I, and that is that near the end, when this thing finally got itself going and was up off the ground, another person in the group got into a Cessna to fly up and fly with it, and I went with him. And at that point, I had to say, I got in the Cessna. Otherwise, how did this author suddenly appear 1,000 feet in the air? And so I took that into the New Yorker, and my editor there, Bob Bingham, said, that's just can't be. It sticks out like a sore thumb, this I way over near the far end of the story. And he said, can't you find a place at least to do it one other time? And so I hunted around in the front of the piece and found a scene that happened in a Exxon station somewhere, and I put the I in there, and I still regret it. but only because it didn't belong. I mean, I'm not shy to say I if there's no alternative.
We'll get back to our 1989 interview with John McPhee after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with John McPhee, who won a Pulitzer Prize this week. I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book, The Control of Nature, 3 reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides. I asked what led him to the subject.
I have a daughter named Sarah, who was in college in the 6 or 7 years ago, and was taking a course from Robert Coles, on the work of Walker Percy. And she was totally swept away by Walker Percy and wanted to go to Walker Percy country for a spring vacation. And I said, fine, we'll go down there, but what's in it for Dad? And after some research, what was in it for Dad was a canoe trip in a brief one in the Atchafalaya Swamp. With an LSU professor and another friend of ours, and the 4 of us went out into the swamp. And while I was there, I learned that all of the water in the swamp was controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at a place called Old River, where they were valving the Mississippi and preventing it from going off in a direction in which the Mississippi wants to go, but in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wanted it not to go. And I thought that was a wonderfully symbolic situation of the flat-out struggle between human beings and nature, because the Mississippi has greatly shifted its course down there about once every 1,000 years. And the time had come in the 1950s and thereabout for this to happen. And so they're down there trying to prevent it. And when I got the idea of doing a piece on that and all its implications and ramifications, I thought of doing more pieces in the same theme. And a man at the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg said, well, if you're interested in this theme, you ought to go to Los Angeles and look into the debris basins. And I said, you know, the debris basins? And he said, yeah, they're catching the falling rocks of the San Gabriel Mountains to keep them off Johnny Carson and so on.
One of your 3 pieces in the new book is called Los Angeles Against the Mountains, and it's about the debris flow. There's a paragraph in that I'd like you to read that kind of describes the magnitude of the debris?
In geology, it would be known as a debris flow. Debris flows amass in stream valleys and more or less resemble fresh concrete. They consist of water mixed with a good deal of solid material, most of which is above sand size. Some of it is Chevrolet size. Boulders bigger than cars ride long distances in debris flows. Boulders grouped like fish eggs pour downhill in debris flows. The dark material coming toward the Genophiles was not only full of boulders, it was so full of automobiles it was like bread dough mixed with raisins. On its way down Pine Cone Road, it plucked up cars from driveways and the street. When it crashed into the Genophile's house, the shattering of safety glass made terrific explosive sounds. A door burst open. Mud and boulders poured into the hall. "We're going to go," Jackie thought. "Oh my God, what a hell of a way for the four of us to die together."
It's a really wonderful descriptive writing in that paragraph. I really like the Chevrolet-sized boulders. I think it was just the right word to use. My guest is writer John McPhee. I've always thought of your style and part as finding the macrocosm and the microcosm, looking at something very specific and looking at it so carefully that suddenly things much larger, ideas much larger, begin to emerge. And this one person or one phenomenon that you're looking at becomes almost a metaphor for things larger than itself. Does that jive at all with the way you see your kind of writing?
Well, I sort of hope that happens. I'm glad to hear you say that. but I don't. I think it would be dangerous to sit down and say, and force something like that. You know, you just by attending to the story you're trying to tell, you may hit such a level. But I don't consciously try to do that.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest amount of time you've ever spent on one story?
3 years.
And which one was that?
Coming into the Country.
What was it, about Alaska?
About Alaska.
And you lived there for the full 3 years, or
no,
you went back
oh
and
no.
forth?
No, oh no. I went up there about 4 times for visits ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. And in the rest of the time, I was at home in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, working on that piece at home. There was a great deal of reading involved, and of course, the writing always takes longer. I was figuring the other day, it takes about 7 days in Princeton for every one that I'm out somewhere, generally.
You mean 7 days of writing?
Yeah, I mean, people will ask me, "Does your family miss you?" And I say, "They're only too happy to get rid of me," because I'm back there writing, you know, 7 or 8 days for every one that I'm traveling. And so, and furthermore, the writing goes on. I mean, it might last 15 months, the 15 months of writing. And if you've ever lived with somebody who's doing 15 months of writing, you'd be glad to get rid of them too. And so then the time comes up and I go off for a couple of weeks and then come back again. That's how it works. It's most of the effort is at, locked away in a room by yourself.
John McPhee recorded in 1989. This week, his book Annals of the Former World won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. This is Fresh Air.